Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why dust could be causing problems for the West's water supplies. And we'll meet the creator of a new children's TV show focusing on the Navajo Nation. But first, a bill that would set up a way to pay for repairs and upgrades at Chase Field had been working its way through the state legislature this year, but recently had stalled. Now negotiations between the governor's office, lawmakers, the team, City of Phoenix, and Maricopa County seem to be leading to optimism that there can be a deal reached before the end of the session. Under the original version of the plan, sales tax revenue generated at Chase Field would go into a fund for the stadium. It would also have included income taxes from stadium employees. But city and county officials worried about the amount of money that would be diverted away from their coffers under that arrangement. Stacy Barchenger, state politics reporter for the Arizona Republic, has written about a recent meeting that seems to have made some progress toward a compromise, although a seemingly offhanded comment has also become part of the story. She joins me to talk about all this. And Stacy, let's start with that comment that one of the participants made about basically tying this bill to the future of the Cactus League. Is that right?
Yeah, so this comment came at the end of this private meeting last week in the governor's office about what this Diamondbacks bill looks like. It was made by Andrew Cohn, who describes himself as sort of this intermediary who is there just for the benefit of the city and the team to get a deal done. And depending on who you talk to, who is in the room, a couple of people took it as an insinuation or a threat that there could be consequences for spring training if a deal is not reached. But Cohn, denies that that was his intention.
The implication being that Major League Baseball would either remove or reduce the size of the Cactus League if the D-backs, for example, could not get this bill done and didn't stay in Phoenix?
Yes, that they would pull spring training. And I should say the team says that there is no association between this deal and spring training. And I have not spoken to anyone who thinks that that is a reality, but this is apparently how the comment was made in the meeting.
So what did Cohn say he actually did mean by that comment?
Yeah. So he said that there was a discussion about what would happen if they couldn't reach a deal, and that he had spoken to former MLB commissioner Bud Selig, who he considers a friend, kind of about this situation. He told me, and I will quote him here, that it is a terrible look to have such a commitment to the Cactus League and spring training in Arizona and not have a hometown team here. That's how he recalls the conversation.
And of course, the implication there is that if this bill doesn't pass, the Diamondbacks presumably leave Chase Field, maybe just leave the Valley altogether?
That there is some presumption there, but I will say the Diamondbacks have said again and again and again that they are committed to Phoenix and they're committed to Arizona and they are not leaving.
So who is Andrew Cohn? You refer to him as sort of a self-described intermediary for both the city and the team, but it should be noted that on this particular issue, the city and the team do not necessarily see eye to eye on what the right answer is.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And he, he's been involved for several years on negotiations between the team and the county over Chase Field and the lease and the repairs that have led to this bill, or I guess the discussion about who pays for the repairs that have led to this bill. And he says that he was invited to this meeting by Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego. The city says that is incorrect, but he describes it as him being there on behalf of the city and the team's interests, and that he is, a representative of citizens, right? That he's just trying to reach a deal so that the Diamondbacks stay in Arizona.
Huh. So this is a bill that has gone through a couple of different iterations. Does it seem as though there might be some agreement between the team and the city and the county over how to handle maybe diverting some amount of tax revenue from those levels of government to the team to fund repairs and upgrades at the stadium?
Yeah, I mean, after this closed door meeting, we heard optimism coming from Governor Katie Hobbs, whose office led that meeting. Maricopa County Supervisor Tom Galvin said he felt really good about it. Mayor Gallego has not commented publicly, so that's sort of still hanging out there. But it sounds like what they talked about is sort of, blending these different aspects of versions of the bill that have been, put in and then taken out over the last 4 months to come to some agreement.
I know that there's been some talk, for example, of putting a cap on the amount of tax revenue that would be diverted, for example, from the city and the county to the stadium so that maybe the city and the county could still get some of that sales tax revenue. Is that something that seems to be on the table?
That was discussed in the meeting, both a cap for the city of Phoenix to limit the amount of sales tax hit that they take, and then also an overall cap so that there is some limit on the number of taxpayer dollars that come from the city, state, and county to pay for repairs at Chase Field.
And I know that earlier on, the tax would also have included income taxes from employees at Chase Field, including the Diamondbacks players themselves. Is that still something under consideration?
Yeah, that apparently is back in. That had been taken out of the latest version of the bill, but now I guess is back under discussion. It would be the income tax from players and other employees at Chase Field that would go, from the state's coffers back to repairs at the stadium.
What is it about the sort of the talks and maybe what is seeming to emerge in this new version of the bill that is giving folks like Supervisor Galvin confidence?
Well, I mean, based on the notes and what I have heard about this meeting, the county was really worried that they would take a greater tax hit in the latest version of the bill, but it seems like that has been limited to just impacting or pulling from their road tax. So I think that is certainly a point of optimism. It seems like there are some caps that have been discussed, like the mayor and the county had wanted. Although I should say, this is all under discussion. There is another meeting this week. Nothing has been written down yet, which I think is when we will really see what the final sort of agreement looks like.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, there's another meeting scheduled for this week. Does it seem as though this is something that the parties are confident can get done as the session maybe in theory starts to be considered to be winding down a little bit?
I mean, they certainly are saying publicly that they think they can get this across the finish line as the session winds down.
All right, that is Stacey Bartschenger, state politics reporter with the Arizona Republic. Stacey, thanks as always. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Representative Juan Ciscomani, a Republican congressman from Arizona's 6th District, joined us recently to talk about his work on the Conservative Climate Caucus. Among other things, he described what he sees as a legislative strategy that acknowledges the existence of climate change while looking for pro-business solutions to the issue. Today, for a Democratic perspective on climate, we're joined by Representative Yasemin Ansari. Before she was elected to the House in 2024, Ansari served as a climate advisor at the UN and planned the 2016 Climate Action Summit. During her time on the Phoenix City Council, she created the city's Office of Heat Response and Mitigation and pushed to electrify city vehicles like buses and fire trucks. Ansari spoke with my co-host, Sam Dingman.
So we recently had Representative Juan Ciscomani on the show, and he's a member of the Conservative Climate Caucus. And one of the things that they're focused on is partnering with private industry to address climate change, in part by removing some regulations on those industries. An example that he cited is mining, where there are environmental concerns about mining, but there are also critical minerals that we need from mining operations to maintain production of, for example, electric cars. How do you see private industry and regulations around industry as being part of the vision for a future that acknowledges climate change?
Well, there's no question that we can't address climate change without the deep and significant involvement of the private sector. But what we've seen from these companies is really doubling down. That is why this industry decided to invest over $1 billion and getting Donald Trump elected. There's, of course, the very notable example of him publicly saying and pleading to oil and gas companies to say, hey, like, if you invest in me getting elected, I will make sure you are rewarded. And that is what's happening now. That is exactly what's happening when the president is, you know, issuing executive orders, rolling back every environmental policy that has gotten us to this point where we're making progress on climate change. He pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. He is wanting to open up public lands and, you know, expand offshore drilling of oil and gas, all the while not even trying to promote wind and solar in any meaningful way, and in fact, reversing course on that front. So, you know, if the truth was that oil and gas wanted to be a responsible part of the solution, that would be great. I think people would welcome that. But instead, they are making record profits, getting handouts like no other industry, and not acting in a way that is at all geared towards moving us into the future.
So the EPA administrator, Lee Zeldin, has talked about a lot of proposed changes that the administration wants to make around climate policy as, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but driving a dagger through the heart of the climate change religion. I asked Representative Siskamani the same question. What is your reaction to that statement?
I continue to struggle to understand why people like Lee Zeldin, Donald Trump, and Republicans don't want to follow basic science. I mean, it is oil and gas companies back in the 1970s, along with our U.S. military establishment, like the United States Navy, who sounded the alarm on the damage that climate change is causing. I can tell you in Phoenix, Arizona, we have more than 600 people die every single summer from extreme heat, and still don't have any sort of support from FEMA or the federal government when it comes to resilience or to combating this issue.
So let me ask you, Congresswoman, I mean, clearly you feel like there is great urgency here to address the issue of climate change. But it continues to be an issue, it seems, where it is difficult to bring it to the top of the urgency list for the voting public writ large. What, in your mind, have been successful strategies that you have seen in your work on this issue that you would like to see your colleagues in Congress who agree with you undertake?
When I knock on doors in my district in Phoenix, I often talk with my constituents about the impacts of air pollution. There are so many parents in the district who feel the impacts of the poor air quality that we have in Phoenix. We're ranked about fifth nationwide for worst ozone pollution. And they know that because their kids are getting asthma at much higher rates than in previous generations. You know, we're seeing higher lung cancer rates than usual. And they feel these impacts so directly on their health. On the flip side, on the positive of that, jobs. I mean, the benefit of the Inflation Reduction Act are immense in a place like Phoenix. I mean, labor unions who are super split politically, you know, we're talking about plumbers and pipe fitters, carpenters, painters, they are so excited and, you know, thrilled to be part of building, you know, solar plants or building new wind projects across our state that are a result of funding that we received from the federal government over the last couple of years. And now that that's been paused, I think many are concerned that, you know, their jobs will be at risk. So I really think climate change, the threats are so intense and significant that I think it's important to really localize it to the extent possible.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Inflation Reduction Act, because that's something that Representative Siskamani also brought up. And it makes me want to ask you a little bit about the dynamic around that legislation at the moment from your perspective, because he talked about wanting to preserve some elements of the IRA, mm-hmm. in particular the clean energy tax credits. Do you think points of agreement like that are indicative of any sort of bipartisan spirit when it comes to climate legislation in the current Congress. Are you optimistic about finding any common ground?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a great example of where there is really bipartisan support. I think this like push and pull really highlights, unfortunately, the role of money in politics and what an outsized influence it can have and why it's so harmful. Because the truth is, not only did the majority of Americans believe in climate change and the science behind it, but I think, you know, even polling on something like electric vehicles is up. However, you have an oil and gas industry that is worried. And so they spent the $1 billion to get their choice elected as president. And now that is the reason why we are moving back so far. And that's my concern, is that not only on the issue of climate, but so many other issues, the policy is actually moving in a direction that most Americans don't agree with. And why is that? It's because of that industry's role with the money that they've spent.
All right. Well, that is Congresswoman Yasemin Ansari, who is a member of the U.S. House representing Arizona's 3rd Congressional District. Congresswoman, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the rise of a local French fry food truck turned potato supplier.
So there was not in that moment the idea to evolve into a wholesaler, but the opportunity presented itself when he saw that his customer base was more heavily restaurateurs.
We'll hear how Fried Street got supersized beyond just selling fries. But first, snowmelt and the runoff from it are critical to water supplies in the valley and across the region. But new research suggests another part of the ecosystem, dust, can have a negative impact on that. Mackenzie Skiles is an associate professor in the School of Environment, Society, and Sustainability at the University of Utah and director of the Snow Hydrology Research to Operations Laboratory. She joins me to talk about this research, which looked at more than two decades worth of satellite data. And Mackenzie, when you're talking about a dust cover on snow, is this the same kind of dust that would accumulate maybe on your back patio from stuff not being moved around? What exactly are we talking about?
Yeah, it's similar. We're talking about mineral dust. So dust that comes from arid regions, from disturbed regions. Dust can encompass a number of aerosols, including stuff like soot and biological material. But what we study is really dust from arid regions.
And what is the impact of having this dust landing on top of snow? It seems as though it makes it melt more quickly, but why is that?
Yeah, so you could think of it as being something like the difference between wearing a white or black shirt on a sunny day. Snow is really naturally quite bright. It's the brightest natural surface on Earth. It reflects up to 90% of incoming sunlight. And almost anything is darker than snow. So when you put this dark mineral dust on top of the snow surface, it absorbs more sunlight, and that additional energy makes the snow melt faster.
And what are the implications of that? Like, why does that matter?
Yeah, so one, we don't know how much dust is going to come every year. We do know that we see dust deposited on the snowpack every year, but the impact of that dust varies from year to year. And it's not accounted for in snowmelt models. And snowmelt is our primary water resource in the West. And we make a lot of plans about storing and using that snowmelt as it comes out of the mountains. And so forecasting the timing and magnitude of snowmelt is really critical to using that water resource in an efficient way. And if it melts earlier and faster than we're expecting it, then we might not use it in the best way. It might come earlier than we expect. And also, when it melts out earlier, that means the landscape dries out earlier and dries out sooner in the summer. And that eventually can lead to less total water yield downstream.
Why is it a problem if the snowmelt happens earlier on? I mean, does that not just mean we get the water a little bit earlier than we expected?
Yeah, there is some practical implications of this. Is We use snow melt for irrigation. That's the main use of water is agriculture in the watering us. And what we want is that water to be available when we need it for irrigation. But if the water comes too early, the ground is still cold and it's not growing season yet. And so the water is not coming when we need it most. And then it also might be coming too early for reservoir operations. You need to know when the water is coming in order to store it for later use.
Does it matter how much dust is on top of the snow to affect how much it melts and when it melts?
Yes, the amount of dust matters, and also the color of the dust matters. So, in years when there's not much dust deposited, the impact is still there, but it's not as big of magnitude. When there's frequent dust events that bring a lot of dust to the snow surface, then the impact to snow melt can be up to 2 months faster snow melt. And in the Colorado Rockies, we get dust from the Southern Colorado Plateau, and that dust is very dark and iron rich. It's red. And so it has a more dramatic impact on snow melt. In other regions, we see yellow or brown dust, and that won't have as dramatic of an impact on snow melt rates.
What can be done about this? I mean, you mentioned where the dust comes from in the Rocky Mountains. Like, it's not like you can go and like put a giant sheet over the landscape to prevent dust from flying about. So, like, what do you do about this?
Yeah, so we do know that there has been more dust since modern settlement and widespread sort of land use change and surface disturbance of the West. Surface soils can be fragile, and once they're disturbed, it takes them a long time to heal. And so, one of the things that we know that we can do is to minimize surface disturbance and land use change in regions that are prone to dust emission and transport. And that can be, as simple as just knowing which regions are likely to produce dust and minimizing land use change in those areas.
So not maybe developing areas that are more prone to kicking dust up into the air, which eventually lands on snow.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So, and that sort of land use change and surface disturbance can come in many forms. It can be grazing, it can be building roads for oil and gas development, it can be off-highway vehicle use. It's any number of things. And so understanding which areas are most prone to disturbance and dust emission is important. And then targeting those areas for dust mitigation and restoration, is also important.
Has your research suggested that we have missed out on water over the past however many years, like because maybe it melted too early and we just weren't ready for the runoff?
Yeah, so previous work before this study showed that earlier snow melt leads to earlier green up timing across the landscape. And that green up timing, vegetation blooming earlier, takes up more water. And so the water goes to the landscape or evaporates into the air and doesn't make it as runoff downstream. And that can reduce total water yield by about 5% in dramatic dust impact years. And that can be a hard number to interpret, but that's about half of LA's water allocation from the Colorado River.
And that seems like a lot.
Yes, that can be it's a dramatic impact. And it's not that level of impact every year, but in the years where we see a lot of dust, we might be seeing less total water yield.
Are there particular factors that lead to more dust being in the air and then landing on snow?
This is a question that we would like to understand better and probably the focus of future research. Currently, we can't predict when we're going to have a big dust event or that any given season is going to produce a lot of dust. There are some obvious factors that lead to dust, so high wind speeds, dry surface soils in these emission regions, but in any given year, we can't actually predict when we're going to get a dust event. We know when they're happening, and then we can monitor the impact afterwards. But more research is needed to understand what leads to dust events and then what leads to dust events that are higher magnitude than other dust events.
All right. Mackenzie, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Mackenzie Skiles is an associate professor in the School of Environment, Society, and Sustainability at the University of Utah and director of the Snow Hydrology Research to Operations Laboratory. Rachel Monroe covers the Southwest for The New Yorker, where she recently published an article called "The Decline of Outside Magazine is Also the End of a Vision of the Mountain West." It's a requiem of sorts for the heyday of Outside, which for decades has offered its readers some of the most ambitious outdoor and investigative journalism found anywhere. Launched in the 1970s by veterans of Rolling Stone magazine, Outside published the original versions of seminal works of adventure journalism, like Sebastian Younger's The Perfect Storm and Jon Krakauer's Into Thin Air. As Monroe told my co-host Sam Dingman, at its height, that's the kind of editorial ambition Outside was known for.
I talked to some folks from the early days who kind of contrasted the Outside magazine approach to me with the National Geographic. You know, if National Geographic told a story as like it's, you know, a kind of hushed and reverent account of a walk through the jungle, Outside was just, you know, the writers were going to be like riding there in a rattling pickup truck, you know, maybe getting in trouble along the way.
Yeah. And importantly, this wasn't just part of the journalistic tradition and kind of zeitgeist of the moment. It also was a place that, as you write, crystallized a certain American perception of the West.
Yeah, I think it was really important that Outside Magazine, for most of its legacy, and particularly its, like, you know, golden years, was based in Santa Fe. So we have a media industry that's so concentrated on the coasts in a lot of ways, and that, for better or for worse, but that impacts a lot of the stories that are told. And this was a magazine that was just very explicitly like looking, pointed in another direction, oriented in another way, you know, sitting among the mountains. And everybody who worked there, you know, was a person who spent time in the West fishing, biking, skiing in the 70s and 80s. That felt kind of radical.
So it is not necessarily a new story for a magazine like that to be purchased by a very rich person who changes the philosophy of what the place is. But I do think it would be interesting in this case to talk about the specifics of how that happened at Outside in particular. 4 years ago, the magazine was purchased by Robin Thurston. Who is Robin Thurston?
Robin Thurston is a former kind of elite cyclist who got his start. He founded sort of an early fitness tracking app. He sold it to Under Armour, made a bunch of money, and then has since then has been kind of in this tech entrepreneur space.
And would it be fair to say that one of the things that he did when he bought Outside Incorporated was to try to sort of like transform it from a magazine that was focused primarily on long form journalism into sort of like a lifestyle brand?
I don't know if it was necessarily the intention going in was to turn Outside away from this legacy of really high quality, serious investigative reporting and long form reporting. It just seemed like where it was not where the new owner's priorities were. There was a particular story that came up multiple times that I think rubbed a lot of folks the wrong way, where Outside had published a quite amazing investigation into a climber who had sexually assaulted several women in the climbing world. And this was incredibly well reported and well written and really indicted the climbing community, because a lot of this was sort of an open secret. A lot of people, you know, these women told their story and kind of weren't listened to, and people kind of kept giving this guy another chance. And it was really awful. And he since then has been sentenced to, I believe, like life in prison for all these assaults.
Wow.
But Outside, this is, you know, the classic kind of Outside story where it's just holding this community to account. And the new person kind of running the content operation at Outside in an all hands meeting said, you know, hey, that story was great, but that's the kind of thing we need to move away from. Because what we need to focus on more is we're trying to motivate people to go outside. And so what we want is like positive, uplifting I think for a lot of people, that was like the final straw.
Yes. Well, if I'm not mistaken, last month, a number of the magazine's editors, writers, and photographers signed an open letter to the ownership of the magazine asking to be removed from the masthead. In that open letter, they say, quote, "Despite the vast sums of money you have raised to consolidate the adventure media industry, your company now seems intent on destroying what Outside once stood for."
Yeah, I think, you know, at the time of acquisition, a lot of people told me that they were incredibly hopeful. I mean, Outside, you know, we don't want to say, don't want to paint too rosy of a picture. At the time of the acquisition 5 years ago, the magazine had a lot of problems. They were really notorious for like not paying freelancers or paying them like years later. They had hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt that they owed to writers. So people thought like, hey, yeah, this person's coming in. He's like, he's a committed cyclist. You know, he seems to really want to, you know, bring money into this thing that like a lot of people are really committed to. And it felt initially like there was a real commitment to, you know, to usher it into the next era, basically.
You write in the piece that you get the sense that the frustration that a lot of Outside staffers were feeling was indicative of some larger sentiment. And one of them in particular says to you, quote, "It just seemed like to a lot of us watching from afar, is this the way people are now? Is this the way they live their life?"
Oh, that was the great writer Hampton Sides, who's, you know, another early Outside contributor and wonderful writer. You know, Outside in the early days, it was kind of the lifestyle that it sold was this idea that you could go out west and spend time in nature and like live a kind of a cheaper life, closer to, you know, be closer, more in touch with nature, more in touch with reality. And then that was like available to people who sort of had this bold, adventurous, curious, like questing spirit. And it just seems like harder and harder to do that now with the way so much of the Mountain West has just gotten incredibly expensive, has gotten privatized, and the spread of tech, you know, and tech wealth into a lot of these towns, into, you know, Montana and Idaho. I just think that that's, you know, in a way, this idea of like tech money coming in and, you know, wanting the brand of Outside, but like not committing to what actually made it great. It just felt like it tied into these larger forces that people in the Mountain West are contending with.
Yeah, I saw a stat somewhere and I can't remember if this was in your piece or not, but over 70% of the West's population lives in cities. So it just makes me think about what you were just saying, that as this place that helped form the perception of and appreciation of the West is changing, the actual constitution of the West is also undergoing this metamorphosis.
Definitely. And I think, you know, that the kind of outdoor adventure that Outside writers Outside used to cover, both in investigative pieces and then also like in fun, you know, just fun kind of travel gear review type work, that's increasingly, I think, a luxury good. You know, it's harder and harder to be like a, you know, a dirtbag climber, just camping out. The people who work in these mountain towns often have to live, you know, like an hour away or something because there's no affordable housing for them. The dream that we're kind of sold in images is increasingly distant from the reality of it.
Well, Rachel Monroe is a contributing writer at The New Yorker, where she covers Texas and the Southwest. And her piece for The New Yorker magazine that we've been discussing is called "The Decline of Outside Magazine is Also the End of a Vision of the Mountain West." Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. A new children's TV show follows a Navajo child from the city who decides she wants to spend the summer with her grandmother who lives on the Navajo Nation. Sadie, though, is a puppet, as are many of the characters on Navajo Highways. It'll start streaming tomorrow on a platform called First Nations Experience. Pete Sands is a filmmaker and writer from the Utah portion of the Navajo Nation. He's also the writer and director of Navajo Highways. He joins me to talk more about the project. And Pete, where exactly did the idea for the series come from?
Well, I had this idea I started in 2020. I got an idea when I was out in New York Fashion Week. And I got to visit Sesame Street at the same time back in 2019. And came back to the reservation to work on the COVID relief program that I started. And during that time, I ran to a lot of families who were experiencing communication difficulties with the older generation staying at home with the younger generation. The language barrier was there. And I just thought, how can I help? And I just had this experience with a teacher who was using a puppet to talk to her students. And the light went off in my head, like, hey, maybe I can use puppets to teach a language. So that's how it came. And Sesame Street was very vital and helped show me how they do things back. And it was just a combination of that.
How did you try to incorporate the influence maybe of Sesame Street while not making it just sort of a Navajo Nation version of Sesame Street?
The difference between Sesame Street and Navajo Highways is Sesame Street does not use human puppets. Everything is, they call it beastazoids. So like if you think of every puppet that's on Sesame Street, it's not a person. And Navajo Highways, what I want to do is focus on the culture, because I didn't want to use like childish voices, like, hi, my name is, you know, I wanted to use it like real people, like real voices. You know, I wanted them to make them be as real as they can, but also appealing to kids.
Yeah. Well, and interestingly, one of the main things that Sesame Street aims to do and has really from the very beginning is talk about literacy and, you know, help kids sort of learn their letters and learn their colors and learn to read, things like that. It sounds like in that sense, with the Diné language, that is very much what you're after here.
Yes, a lot of programs. I mean, you think of all the childhood programs besides Sesame Street, all the childhood programs I've watched as kids, there's always a teaching tool. There's always an educational teaching tool. And, you know, Native Americans, Indigenous people have always been very creative and very artistic in the way they preserve their culture. So I just stuck with that cultural approach of using visual aid to teach language and culture.
What was the process of writing the episodes and filming it like?
Writing the episodes was a bit of a challenge because, you know, how do you balance culture and language with the show and still keep it entertaining? And as well as you got to consider that the audience is watching this, you know, just because a person's Navajo, have Navajo heritage or lineage, does not know, it doesn't mean they understand language or they have been exposed to it. So I had to keep that in mind because I was doing speeches and conferences on Navajo language and preservation for years. And I know that Navajo language at the fluency at this time is below 10% of the Navajo population. Mm. So I had to write the show to where it catered to the much greater percentage of people who weren't able to speak the language. So that balance was tough, but also how do you connect with that audience that is coming into this show not knowing much about the culture or the language? So that's why I made the main character an urban Navajo child who comes from the city, born in the city, and she wants to spend time on the reservation with her grandma. So the audience can go along with her and learn with her.
Does that make maybe the character and the content that you're trying to provide a little more relatable to viewers, do you think?
Yes, that's what I was mainly concerned with, is the audience to relate to this character. And, you know, so they don't feel like they're being taught something, they're being left out of the conversation. Because this is a learning tool. It's about teaching people. I mean, a lot of the folks who've watched, they understand the concept of it now. Because when I try to explain it to people, they're like, what? A puppet show about Navajo language, but they don't talk the language. But you also got to remind the audience that this is for children.
Did you find that, you know, based on sort of the fluency levels and, you know, where viewers might be starting out from, did you have to maybe think about making the lesson part of this a little more maybe rudimentary than you might have wanted to?
There's a lot of elements of what I was influenced with me when I was a child, and being able to have more than just the message of the word within the episode, because they have to learn what that word means. Like what it really resonates with them. And, you know, in Navajo and Diné, a word could mean five different things. Mm. So getting to the root of that word, and also learning about the culture, about the lifestyle on the reservation, what it means to live on the reservation, what does it mean to grow up in the culture? So it's more than just the language.
How do you gauge whether or not this series has the impact that you're hoping it has?
I think the reaction from the audiences, because before we even did the TV show, I used to go out and do presentation because I did small video skits from web video skits for students where they learn like how to introduce themselves in Dene. And I would take these videos and these little skits out to the elementary schools on the Navajo reservation. And the crazy amount of response I got from the kids was off the charts. I mean, just imagine like 200, 300 kids from kindergarten to third grade just screaming at the top of their lungs, you know, saying their words back to the, with the puppets and just enjoying it. And it's just, and people send me, like parents and grandparents send me videos of their kids watching little videos I have. And I think that's the gauge, right?
I mean, it sounds like it's already having a bit of an impact before it even comes out.
Yeah, when we did our screening in Window Rock, our premiere, our debut, I wasn't prepared for the emotional impact it would have on the older generations, because there's a lot of grandparents in the audience there, and a lot of them spoke up saying, this is what we need. This is what we're looking for, something to teach our young kids so they can look at it on TV, but they're speaking our language properly. There's a couple episodes that they feel like, you know, we do flashback scenes for some of the episodes back in the old days. So it's really, it touched them and it moved them. And it just the overwhelming outpouring of emotion and gratitude from the older generation really, really was really overwhelming. And I didn't expect that.
That must have been really gratifying for you.
I think it's a little validation, you know, like,
yeah.
You don't know if it's going to work. Like, I didn't know it was going to work. I'm just like the crazy guy with the puppet idea. I don't know if it's going to work. And then you see this reaction from people. And it also you get reactions from non-natives who watch it. And they're like, hey, you know, I got a friend who's Navajo, or I got a nephew who's Navajo, and we're trying to connect with him. And the show is going to do that for us. So like just the trailer. People saw the trailer and they were going crazy over it. They're like, this is amazing. It's gratifying, I guess is the word.
Yeah. All right. That is Pete Sands, writer and director of the new series Navajo Highways. Pete, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. French fries are nearly ubiquitous on menus across the state and around the country, but a Valley-based company is working to break into the market to get its potatoes on your plate in a restaurant. Mignon Gould is associate editor at the Phoenix Business Journal and has written about Fried Street, which is aiming to be a disruptor in this space. She joins me. And Mignon, Fried Street had a successful operation as a food truck, then decided they were going to move to something else. What led to that change?
You know, after talking to Flip, who is one of the co-founders of the original food truck, he made it clear that they were a successful food truck business, but he realized that most of the revenue that they were getting was coming from chefs who were actually coming, buying their potatoes in bulk and repurposing them in their own restaurants and adding their own, using them to make their own recipes. So it was something in the ballpark of 500 to 750 pounds of potatoes that they were actually selling through that avenue.
So basically they went from selling their own French fries, their own, you know, sort of creations, to just selling the, for lack of a better word, the raw material to chefs who were then doing their own thing with them.
Exactly. He basically went from being a food truck chef to being a wholesaler to other chefs, restaurants, or resorts, etc. Definitely.
Was that something that he had aspired to do?
No, actually, it was an aha moment. The passion was to make these great French fry concoctions. He'd make his own type of French fry, and then they had toppings on top of them. So there was not in that moment the idea to evolve into a wholesaler, but the opportunity presented itself when he saw that his customer base was more heavily restaurateurs.
Was there any hesitation to doing that? I can just imagine if you are somebody who has all these creative ideas for what to do with food, and then all of a sudden you go from that to just selling, and I'm using air quotes, just selling the raw material to being a wholesaler, that might feel like sort of you're losing a part of what you're trying to do.
Well, he, from my understanding, Flip actually, when he saw that he was having such a great response from chefs, he looked into the industry and saw that there was four major players in the industry who were pretty much monopolizing the industry. So he saw an opportunity, which is what all brilliant small business owners do, for his raw potato to enter that market, because he kind of had a unique process as to how he developed his.
How big is the French fry industry?
It is a billion-dollar industry. I believe something like $24.6 billion. Hmm. And the four companies that right now pretty much monopolize it are Lamb Weston, J.R. Simplot, McCain Foods, and Cavendish Farms. And they've allegedly been embroiled in kind of behavior where they're trying to monopolize the industry. And so this is why Flip and his team saw that this was a great opportunity for them to enter, because they did have a product that was somewhat different than what was already on the market.
So what did he say about how he tried to break in? I mean, these companies have been around for a while and, you know, do most, if not all, of the business in the French fry world. So how do you go about trying to become a new company that's trying to enter that market?
Well, especially with small businesses, the key is really starting local. And that is what he did. He really started local, started with a food truck. And as you can imagine, when you have a food truck, if your food is good, you get a local reputation. And as I kind of learned from interviewing him, that really grew in the restaurant industry. And so he started making a name for himself, where chefs were like, this is an amazing French fry. We're able to create an amazing dish from it. And so his name grew there, and he's in over 200 different restaurants, resorts, cafes here just in Arizona, and over 400 across the country. So that kind of gives you an idea how he kind of crept into the space of these other four big players.
Was it mostly like a word of mouth kind of thing for him to spread beyond just the Phoenix area, beyond Arizona?
Yes, definitely. From my understanding, with how they started with the food truck, it became a word of mouth. But he also, from some information I gathered from the company, he built relationships with people like Chris Bianco, and you probably know him from Pizzeria mm-hmm. Bianco, who was an investor. And actually, their French fries called the Cowboy Chips are actually carried in Bar Bianco. So building those type of relationships with, you know, someone who really has a presence locally and nationally, definitely, I'm sure, aided in him to be able to grow his brand.
So what's next? Like, what kind of aspirations does Fried Street have beyond what they're doing now?
Well, what's next for them, as I discussed in our article that came out on Friday, is they want to enter the retail market. And they've actually working on a deal with Dot Foods, which is a national redistributor. And so what that means is that those French fries, Fried Street fries, could soon be coming to grocery stores near us, so that we can, you know, use our little air fryers and make our own little French fry concoctions.
All right. That is Mignon Gould, associate editor at the Phoenix Business Journal. Mignon, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Mark. Have a great day.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Sam Dingman, I am Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.